I call this talk The Problems of Comparing. And I want to start by reading this verse from the Samyutta Nikaya. When anyone, on the basis of form, which is impermanent, suffering, and subject to change, regards themselves thus, I am superior, or I am inferior, or I am equal. What does that do to apart from not seeing things as they really are? And he's pointing to the idea that we keep creating a sense of a separate self by comparing ourselves. Because as soon as we're comparing, there's me and what I'm comparing to. We've created, just through the mental process we're going through, a sense of separation. And this issue of comparing, you'll see in the suttas and in other places, the translation of the Pali word will be conceit. Which in English has sort of a particular meaning. But it sort of applies here, I think, because like conceit is like thinking you're something you're not. That's in a sense of the other translations you see sometimes are pride, arrogance, or measuring. How do I measure up to that person? And in the tradition, this is called one of the latent torments. It's latent because it's hard to see because it seems so normal, so natural to compare yourself to someone else seems like, well, of course, everybody does that, right? But it causes untold problems. And that's basically what this whole talk is about, is what the problems are and how we can see them and understand them a bit better. This is from Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness. And he's talking about this thing being what he calls a subtle kind of restlessness. Right? Sometimes we worry about our practice. Well, goals and aspirations are key elements in our spiritual journey. The mind can easily be overcome, over-concerned about our progress, about how we think we're doing, obsessing about our enlightenment or lack of it. With this kind of worry, it's very easy to fall into self-judgment, a certain kind of spiritual self-absorption. We start comparing ourselves to other meditators, the length of our sits, the amount of food we take, how slowly we're moving, and our minds can easily get agitated by this worry about our practice. We lose the simplicity of easeful resting in the moment, mindful of whatever is arising. So he's pointing to, especially in formal practice, but also in daily life, when we start thinking about how am I doing? How's my practice going? We often end up seeing that in the light of comparing it to someone else. And then there we are caught in this worry about, oh, they're better than me, or I'm better than them. I sit way more still than they do, or whatever. We get caught in those places, right? Joseph Goldstein has this great story he tells. One of his early sitting practice, long-term sits. He was sitting in India in this very simple setting so that the people didn't have separate rooms. There was a men's dorm and a women's dorm, and the dorms were just like they were divided like a back wall and dividers on two sides, but the front was totally open, and so was the top. So it was like very open situation. And he was determined that he was going to be the best sitter, no matter what. And he, so at night, everybody else, would be turning out. Everybody had their own little light, and they'd turn out their little light and go to sleep and do it. He was going, "Oh, I'm going to be the last one. I'm going to keep sitting. I'm going to be the last one to turn out my light." But 3 or 4 cubicles down from him, there was this other guy whose light was also always on late at night. And no matter what he did, he couldn't stay awake any longer. And every night he'd turn on his light before the other guy. And he got really discouraged. Like, this guy's obviously way more serious than I am, way better than I am, and practicing more diligently, and blah, blah, blah. At the end of the retreat, he's talking to the guy, and he's telling him this whole story about how I was trying to stay up as long as you were, and you're like, I always had to eventually turn out my light and go to sleep, and your light would still be on. And the other guy looks at him with a sort of funny look on his face and says, "Oh, I sleep with my light on." But that's what comparing mind can do. You can get caught in this idea of how someone else is, and you don't have a clue. I mean, the guy was just sleeping with his light on, but poor Joseph was convinced that this guy was, and it caused him a great deal of agitation, just simply, just like that. So this is something we have to watch for. And in that sutta, the little bit of the sutta I read, the Buddha points to these three different: I'm superior, I'm inferior, I'm equal. And I want to look at each of those because they all have different flavors of this comparing mind, this conceit. And better than is always in that space of, I think I'm better than someone else, whether I'm a better, meditator, or a better person, or a better hockey player, or whatever it is. I'm better, right? I'm better than they are, or some group or class of people. And this always creates a sense of separation. Now, how many times did I catch myself thinking, I'm better than those people who vote for Trump? I mean, it was just like, it was so easy to go there because it was like, I'm so much superior to those people, right? Or I'm better than those people who don't meditate. Tsk, tsk. They don't meditate and I meditate. I figured out how to make my life better, and they're still struggling with being regular old unenlightened worldlings, as the Buddha calls them sometimes. And this is part of why it's called conceit, this thing, because that better than energy always has that sort of, aren't I great, sort of vibe to it, right? The Dalai Lama has a great thing to say about this. This is from his book, The Book of Joy. And he's talking about how he consciously makes sure, as best he can, that he doesn't fall into this latent torment. "When I meet someone," the Dalai Lama said, "I'm always try to relate to the person on the basic human level. On that level, I know that just like me, he or she wishes to find happiness, to have fewer problems and less difficulty in their life. Whether I'm speaking with one person or whether I'm giving a talk to a large group of people, I always see myself first and foremost as just another fellow human. That way, there is in fact no need for introduction. If, on the other hand, I relate to others from the perspective of myself as someone different, a Buddhist, a Tibetan, and so on, I will then create walls that keep me apart from the others. And if I relate to others thinking that I am the Dalai Lama, I will create the basis for my own separation and loneliness. After all, there's only one Dalai Lama in the entire world. In contrast, if I see myself primarily in terms of myself as a fellow human being, I will then have more than 7 billion people who I can feel deep connection with. And this is wonderful, isn't it? What do you need to fear or worry about when you have 7 billion other people who are with you?" It just, he's pointing very clearly to the one of the big problems with comparing. As soon as we separate, as soon as we see someone's different from us, then we get into that competitive mind space. And if we just see that, I'm connected to everyone. What Thich Nhat Hanh calls interbeing is the truth, that we're all connected. Then it opens our hearts in ways that just don't otherwise happen. And this sense of separation that we create when we're caught in conceit always creates more suffering for ourselves. Either, I get because I'm separating myself from others, but also because I'm thinking I'm so important, and then I start acting like I'm important, and then someone points out very clearly to me that I'm not, which happens all the time too, right? It's like we just can cause our own suffering and the suffering of others around us really easily. A friend of mine told me a story. This was back when, during one of the previous two election cycles, I'm not sure which. And she was had gone to Denver and was actually staying in a hotel because she was going to visit two friends of hers, and they were all going to go to dinner and having a good time. And she was just sitting in the bar having something to drink before her friends were going to meet her there, right? And she's just sort of sitting there having a drink, and this woman comes up to her. And says, "Oh, because my friend is sort of hippie looking, right?" Says, "You must be one of those paid agitators that goes out and stirs up crowds to make them look bad, that they're hiring to make like this was a whole thing back in the day. One of the talking points that the Republican Party was using was that that people were being paid to be agitators and make it look like these innocent bystanders were all really caught up, getting caught up in." And this woman started ranting about these paid agitators, and then how my friend definitely was one, and my friend was saying, "Oh no, I'm just here, I'm just sitting here having a quiet drink." And this woman was just like totally convinced and was like ranting and ranting. And finally, my friend said, "Actually, I'm just sitting here waiting for my two lesbian friends to come, and all three of us, we're going to go out and have a good time." Just trying to shut her up, shock her, right? And afterwards, as soon as she said it, it was like, oh, she felt so bad because she, first of all, she'd used her friends in a way that wasn't skillful, used their relationship in a way that wasn't skillful. And it was like putting this woman down, and she was trying to put this woman in her place. And she suffered about this for days after. When she told me the story, I could hear the anguish in her voice. And I'm sure this, it's just like that's what we do. Like we create that. She made that person, this person who was ranting at her, an other, and then tried to put her in her place. Because she was obviously better than this other woman. This is just how we act when we're not really consciously careful. This is this way of thinking also leads to what are called the near enemies, things that appear as if they are one of the Brahma Viharas, but they're not. For instance, the near enemy of compassion is pity. Pity is, we sort of feel virtuous when we feel pity, don't we? But pity is always, oh, those poor people down there. It's like not, it isn't connected. We're looking down at those poor people, right? Equanimity, the near enemy of equanimity is indifference. Those other people aren't important. They're not like me, so they're not important. But indifference can look very calm, just like pity can look very compassionate. That's why they're called the near enemies. They appear as if, but they're not. Okay, so that's the first of these three ways. Better than. Then there's worse than. This is how we constantly beat ourselves up and hold ourselves back. This is like, in our culture, this is one of the big diseases of our culture, because we're encouraged to think this way by media and many other things. This is the primary source of doubt. This idea of I'm not good enough. You know, I can't do this. I'm not good enough. I'm not smart enough. I'm not like those other people who can, you know, do all this stuff. I can't. I'm not good enough. And you're just caught in that comparing energy, comparing yourself to these other people. And this then just holds us back from deepening our practice often, because we think, well, no sense in even trying because I'm not good enough. I can't tell you the number of times I've talked to people, students who've come to me with questions, and this is the root of it all. So they don't think they're good enough to do the practice. They're not good enough, pure enough, holy enough, whatever words you want to use, right? I have a teacher, Carol Wilson. I haven't seen her in a long time, but I sat many times with her back in the aughts. And she was, let's say she was, didn't hesitate to sort of say things bluntly. That would be a polite way to put it. And she said, what our culture teaches us, and this is why I'm saying this is a cultural thing, she says, what our culture teaches us is we all believe is, I'm a little piece of shit that the world revolves around. Yeah, huh? And the world, and it's like the world, we all think the world revolves around us. We get caught in that one. You know, I'm no good, but it's all that world. And it just causes untold suffering for ourselves and others again. And here again, we get caught in another of the near enemies. The near enemy of metta is wanting. You know, we want to be better, to see ourselves better than we think we are. We can't accept ourselves as we are in this moment. This is like how we punish ourselves over and over and over again, by believing these things to be true. And I was thinking about this in the context, and some of you might have heard me read these before, but it's like, I love this. People are attracted to what I'll call the self-help section in the bookstore. Have you ever seen this? An enormous section, full of books about read this particular book and all your problems will be solved. Everything will be great, right? And some of them are actually quite decent books. I've got a few on my bookshelf here that have a lot of wisdom in them, but a lot of them are pretty out there, shall I say. And so anyhow, this is how this idea that we're not good enough keeps getting reinforced. Because we keep reading these books like this that say we're not good enough. You have to do this or you won't be good enough. So this is just, I went on Amazon and got a top 10 list of self-help books. This was a few years ago, but it's like, I'm sure if you went, you'd find something quite similar. Healing Your Emotional Self, a powerful program to help you raise your self-esteem, quiet your inner critic, and overcome your shame. It's like, I really want to read that one, huh? When am I going to be happy? How to break the emotional bad habits that make you miserable? And I like the next one, I really like. Change your life and everyone in it. Now, you're not only going to solve your problems, you're going to solve everybody else's problems too. It's like, how the success principle trademarked, right? How to get from where you are to where you want to be. And then these last two. The single woman's sassy survival guide, letting go and moving on. Bestseller for sure, right? And then this one, which I think is actually the most honest one of all of them. The universe doesn't give a flying beep about you. It says it quite clearly, I think, actually. It's probably the most truthful title of all of them. But it's just, this is where we have to see over and over again. We end up in this place where we think we're not good enough. We're comparing ourselves to others. And often it's like there's some mythical others, like, well, all those other meditators must be better than me, you know, blah, 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 whatever. You know, we just get caught in that place. So that's less than, better than. What about equal to? Equal to, I had to think about this one a little bit. Because equal to seems like sort of embedded in our culture in quite deep ways. You know, like that. There it is right there in the Constitution, or is that the Bill of Rights, I forget where it is. All men are created equal. This is built right into our national identity, right? Of course, we have to remember that when they said that, they meant all men, number one. But in fact, they also meant all white men who had property. It was like, well, yeah, and gradually, thank goodness, over the years, that's shifted and changed, but it's part of the cultural idea is that we're all capable of making it in the world. You know, everybody's equal, you know. And I was, you know, I was really bought into this. I come from a very blue-collar, working-class background. I worked my way through college. I'm literally working my way through college. Like my parents didn't have any money, so I just worked, and then you worked and went to school and balanced it out somehow, right? Back then, you could do that. It was like, I'm talking 60 years ago, it was a lot cheaper to go to college. Couldn't do that today, probably. I could. But it was like, you know, pulled myself up by my bootstraps, right? And, you know, I got out of college and I got a really good job and I was making good money and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And, well, if I can do this, guy from this working class family, anybody can do that. So I thought, right? Anybody can do that. But the truth is, in the day-to-day world, we're not all equal at all. Not even slightly. I'm tall. Big advantage. Being 6'4" is a huge advantage in this world, let me tell you. I'm straight. I'm white. I'm well educated. I came from a very loving two-parent family. I had incredible advantages that huge numbers of people don't have at all. You know, they say, you know, you have to get to first base and, you know, all those sort of baseball expressions. Well, I started out on third base. You know, I kept thinking, oh, I got there out of my hard work. I got there just because that was I was how I was born and how I grew up and who I grew up with. People, it isn't, this world is so unequal. And the equal myth built into our culture is a way to sort of ignore and deny how fortunate some of us are and how others aren't. It's like, well, we're all equal, so everybody should be able to do this. Everybody should be able to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, right? Another phrase you hear a lot of times, well, we're all in the same boat, right? Well,
Yeah.
except some must have a yacht and some must have a leaky canoe, right? It's just the way it is. We're not all in the same boat at all. We're all in very different boats. Some don't have a boat at all. Here's one other layer of this problem. And this is actually a problem with all three modes, is that it, and I'm just coming back to this because it's so important. Every time we compare, we create a sense of a separate, solid I. Me, not me. It's just built right into the mind state. So we're always, when we're caught, when we're in this comparing mind, we're creating this, we're separating ourselves from the people, the person, the people, the class, the group, whatever that we're comparing ourselves to. It's built into the mental process itself. This is a little bit, I want to read a little bit of this particular sutta. This is from the Majjhima Nikaya. And the Buddha is talking about the five aggregates of clinging, which is how the main thing he taught as a way to make us see that we're not separate. And it sort of relates to what I just said. Bhikkhus, what do you think? Is material form permanent or impermanent? Good bhikkhus, of course, replied, impermanent, venerable sir. Is what is impermanent suffering or happiness? Suffering, venerable sir. Is what is impermanent suffering and subject to change fit to be regarded thus? This is mine, this I am, this is myself. No, venerable sir. He's pointing to how all the aggregates are a way that you can sort of see everything that we can experience, and that there's no self in any of them. But we cling to things, like he's talking about material form. Well, we cling to our stuff, right? Our car, our partner, our house, our job, our favorite ice cream. Who knows what it is? But we cling to this material form all the time. And then he goes through and he lists all the other material forms. And then he says, therefore, bhikkhus, any kind of material form, whatever, whether past, future, or present, all material form should be seen as it actually is with the proper wisdom. This is not mine. This I am not, this is not myself. And he goes through the other aggregates. Seeing thus, a well-taught, noble disciple becomes disenchanted with material form, disenchanted with feeling tone, disenchanted with perception, disenchanted with mental formations, disenchanted even with consciousness. Being disenchanted, he becomes dispassionate. Through dispassion, his mind is liberated. It's by stopping, just stop comparing. Because the comparing brings us right into this loop over and over and over again. And this thing about comparing mind and the five aggregates. This is the central way the Buddha teaches the whole idea of how we cling to self. In fact, it's not usually not called the five aggregates, they're called the five aggregates of clinging. Very blunt title, right? So then the next question, if no matter whether it's better than, worse than, equal to, if all of these create this sense of separation, what is it, what patterns should we look for that will help us see this process going on. And there are, in the classical teachings, four frames of reference we keep falling into when we are thinking about our life in general, where we always end up comparing. Our birth, wisdom, wealth, and appearance. These are, and I want to talk about each of these because this is where we can start seeing, oh yeah, exactly what I do sometimes without being, and all of these are so, remember this is called a latent torment, right? So this is like built into how we see the world culturally, among other things, but just humanly also. So when the Buddha talked about this, he talked about birth, he was talking very directly about the caste system in India, right? Where, people were born into a certain caste, and if you were in a high caste, like you are a Brahmin or you are a warrior, you had huge advantages. And if not, you were a worker or worst of the worst, you were an untouchable. Where you couldn't even go into a Brahmin's house, and a Brahmin couldn't touch you without having to then go ritually cleanse him or herself. It was like quite, and unfortunately, though this has been, quote, outlawed in India, it's still very much part of the Indian culture. And we see this all the time in our country, right here in this country right now. I'm better because I was born here in America. I'm not an immigrant. How much have we seen that these days? And it's, or this one's even deeper. I'm better because I'm an American, and America is the best country in the world. These are things that are really deeply prevalent in our culture. And though we might want to think, no, I never think like that. Because they're so deep in our culture, sometimes we're acting and speaking in ways that are directly related to these two huge falsehoods. And this kind of thinking causes incredible suffering in the world. And you can see right now in this country, it's all around us all the time. This is what's going on. It's the whole, the scariness of the present moment. And we don't understand how difficult it is for other people who have different experience, like being an illegal immigrant in this country right now. So if you're an illegal immigrant in this country right now, you're always going to be worried and afraid. That's like your life. That's the primary energy of your life. I can't imagine. I was an immigrant. I came into this country as an immigrant, and for a while I had a temporary work permit, and then I had a temporary work permit, and finally I got a green card. But it's all the time I was almost like maybe uncomfortable, just being not official, And I had, there's no way anyone was going to kick me out of this country. I was like, had all the advantages I listed before. But for a lot of people, this is like a big issue. Where you're born. Wisdom. This is another place where we compare. We feel that if we are better, quote, better educated, then we're better in general than those other people. We're the elite educated people. Real easy to fall into that one. How about we feel that because we know the Dhamma, we are better than the other people who don't. That's the one we can fall into sometimes too. I've got things figured out better than those other people, right? Because I know something. And the flip side, and there's also the flip side to this. People can feel that those who are highly educated are snobbish. Think they think they're the elite. You hear the talk about the West and East Coast elites, right? They aren't like me. I'm just a regular working guy. This is the flip side of that equation about business. And so it can go either way, right? The elite don't understand what it's like to be a real American. This is built into the culture again. Then we compare based on wealth. Richer is better. If you're rich, you're better. Right? That's once again built into the culture, built into how I grew up for sure. Because I wasn't, I grew up in a place that, believe me, we weren't, we were rich and we had a loving, caring family. When, in terms of money, I can remember coming back from vacations when I was a kid and us all shaking out our pockets to make sure we're gathering all the change together to get enough gas to get home. That was the world I grew up in. And it was wonderful and we had a wonderful time. We used to go on these great vacations and camp and do things. But it was never like, well, we didn't have any extra. Or sometimes richer is worse, not better, because those rich people are greedy. They're all greedy, those rich people. They think they should have more than me. Not fair. Or if you're poor, you must be bad. Must be lazy. If you're poor, well, everybody is equal. Well, you can pull yourself up by your bootstraps like I did, and we're back to that one again, right? But it's like poor, being poor can be, have poor equals bad, can very easily conjoin. Once again, flip side. I'm proud of my working class roots. Makes me better, more real. I have to really watch this one because it's really deeply embedded in my growing up. We were like blue collar family, and everybody, if you wanted something, you worked for it. You worked for it, and you did it yourself, and you took care of your neighbors and all those sort of working class virtues, right? And that we were better than those other people who didn't understand. And here's one other thing I think we have to really be aware of is we're unconscious, pretty much unconscious, if we're not really careful, but how privileged we are in this culture compared to most of the world. There are poor people in Boulder, but they're pretty invisible. I see them sometimes in hospital when they, when they people who live on the streets and they end up in hospital. But other than that, the other place I saw poor people is when I was doing hospice work and I'd go into, there's a place, a couple of places, one's called Boulder Manor and one's called Vista View, which is where they literally store away poor people who aren't healthy, who are going to die sometime soon. And they stick them there out of the way of, so no one has to see them. That's what we do with poor people. Even here in our culture right here, let alone what's going on out there in the rest of the world where people, the people, the quote, poor people in this country, they had their own, these poor people had their own room and they got three meals a day. This is like incredibly wealthy compared to a lot of people, right? But we don't see, because we don't experience it, we don't see it. It's not clear to us. Finally, the last one is appearance. This is another place where we compare. And this is deeply embedded in our culture, right? this sort of norms, they call them norms because that's what they like to think they are, around physical beauty. You're young, you're fit, you're white, you're blonde, you're tall. That's the ideal that we are sold over and over and over again. And if you're not those things, then you feel less than. Then there's the whole thing about clothes, how we appear by what clothes we wear, and people spend fortunes on clothing that have, designer labels or the most recent fashion or whatever, they're cool or whatever. And it's like, it's all because they want to appear part of the in crowd. I'm better than those other people who aren't. I'm so cool that I dress this way. Because we've been sold that story. Then there's issues around things like the hijab. Women who are devout Muslims wear a hijab. And it becomes this flashpoint for all kinds of ignorance and ill will in our world and our culture. Also, and this is a little personal confession, little, I grew up in a world, and this was in Canada, right, where I never met any people who weren't white. And in fact, one were they all white, almost every one of them was a Christian in some or of some form, right? And so I was like, I had all these growing up, these ideas of how what it meant to be Jewish or black or Native American. I grew up in Canada where the Native Indigenous people were treated horribly. I had in my high school in northern Manitoba, we had Indigenous kids who would sort of make it through grade 9 and then disappear. It was just part of what was happening. And we just compare ourselves in those ways and make ourselves feel superior. People have difficulty with androgyny. People, what was that? There was this, I remember this song when I was a teenager, like, are you a boy or are you a girl with your hair like that? You look, it was like a sort of a funny song about the fact that you couldn't tell the difference, right? And this was like somehow humorous. Maybe I'm just because I don't have much hair left that way. I remember that one. I don't know. I used to have very long, I used to be a long-haired hippie freak. So you have to imagine me with long dreads and a macrame headband to sort of go there. But anyhow, then we have beliefs also when we compare about butch women and swishy men. How we compare that way. Just strictly on appearance, strictly on appearance, and judge people accordingly and compare ourselves to them. And so these, I'm going through this list, not that all of us are, suffer from all of these things, but these are all things that are built right into our cultural thinking, that we have to be aware that we can fall into them without even like consciously being aware that that's what's going on. And so, in general, the reason I went through this whole giant list was just to point out how mindful we need to be that we're not falling into all these cultural comparative forms. That I'm sure my list is nowhere near complete, by the way. This is just, ones I thought of as I was putting this talk together. But it's what we do. And so this is why mindfulness is so important in our daily life, because this is where we can end up reacting or acting in ways that are unwholesome that cause suffering for ourselves and cause suffering for others, totally unconsciously. Totally unconsciously. Just because, well, it's always been that way. Whatever. And because we're in this habit of always comparing ourselves to everyone else. So it's a place where I think we all have to acknowledge that we have a lot of work to do. This is where, in our daily practice world, this is where we really need to do some work. And I want to just repeat this. The whole idea of no matter how we compare, we're creating separation. We're creating a sense of a separate self. Every time we compare, there's a me and a not me. And that creates a sense of a separate self. So we're just through our mental process over and over and over again, creating a sense of a separate self. Read a little bit of Joseph here. He's talking about, well, what's the antidote? If this is so common, if it's so embedded in our cultural way of being, what's the antidote to this? Joseph, of course. This is from his book, Insight Meditation. The antidote to conceit is to drop right back into mindfulness and to focus on the momentariness of phenomena. When our mind is caught in comparison, it is caught in a perception of self and somebody else. We enmesh ourselves in that hallucinatory conceptual framework of self and other. We make such comparisons when we do not see how everything, including the very thought of self and other, is ceaselessly arising and passing away. The contents of these thoughts trap us because we fail to see the impermanence of the thoughts themselves. Comparing mind disappears when we succeed in seeing it. The most powerful antidote is actually just being mindful of this and understanding that it's there in the first place. You know, it's so easy to fall into the, well, I'm not like that. We all are, sorry, me included. We're all that. You know, we all have these tendencies, right? And it's just something we have to be aware of and be mindful of. This is mindfulness in daily life. This is where a lot of the work is done, right here in this realm of comparison. I want to finish. This is a different book of Dana Fald's poems that I read from sometimes. This is called One Soul. And this particular poem seems relevant. It's called Self-Observation Without Judgment. Release the harsh and pointed inner voice. It's just a throwback to the past and holds no truth about this moment. Let go of self-judgment, the old learned ways of beating yourself up for each imagined inadequacy. Allow the dialogue within the mind to grow friendlier and quiet. Shift out of inner criticism, and life suddenly looks very different. I can say this only because I make the choice 100 times a day to release the voice that refuses to acknowledge the real me. What's needed here isn't more prodding about towards perfection, but intimacy, seeing clearly and embracing what I see. Love, not judgment, sows the seeds of tranquility and change. Seems like good advice to me.